Cue the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're at it.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. It is my top five matches, and I've actually lost count of the amount of podcasts we've recorded since lockdown kicked off. Ironic, eh? I think we're on 64 out of 65 days, which ain't too bad going, to be fair, given the lack of football there is out there, and we just had to think outside the box. But speaking of thinking outside the box, I've got a gentleman all the way in Australia. He's not the first Australian football fan we've had on the show. He's the founder of the LFC Couch. It's Nish. How you doing, mate?
Good. Yourself, buddy?
Yeah, all good. Thanks for joining me. I know it's a silly o'clock in the morning out there, so thanks for getting out of bed and doing your hair and all that kind of stuff for the show.
Not really. It's it's very much bed hair at the moment, so you can see me on video. I can't see you, so
you don't want to
so
see
I'm
me.
Being brave in this. Yeah, I'm being brave in this moment. You're the one hiding away.
No, well, yeah, that's it. That's it. I hide behind screens. That's what I do. But
love it.
Well, Nish, before we kick the show off, there's something I need to ask you, because obviously you're in Australia. You're a big Liverpool fan, and judging by the five matches you sent to me, seems like you know your stuff. You're very emotionally invested in the game. I'm not going to ask you the same questions I ask numerous Australian football fans that I've only just met. Like, how did you get involved in the game? Because it's a universal language. But what I really want to ask you, mate, is what is the social media presence like in Australia? And let me just elaborate on this. We have influencers in the UK that perhaps know practically fuck all about the game, whereas people such as yourself, who've known the game, who've been involved in the game in some way, shape or form, are out there constantly putting content out there. Whereas there are some influencers, as I said, they struggled over this period of lockdown. There isn't any football content, so they come up with their own stupid ideas, like drawing a face on a football and trying to make a comedy sitcom, or asking listeners or their followers, shall I read out some German football phrases because the Bundesliga is back, scraping the fucking barrel. So how are you coping at the moment in terms of that content, and what is the general feeling towards these influences in Australia like?
Well, it's Australia hasn't really caught on social media so well. There's still a lot of them are just on Facebook a lot of the time. When it comes to things like Twitter, Instagram's obviously bigger with the younger generation. Twitter, not really at all. I came on Twitter primarily to actually follow the reporters and the journalists and the media in the UK. And this is a few years ago now, like 5 or 6 years ago, I jumped on the Twitter bandwagon. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's full of trash, and it takes a long time to actually work out how do I wade through the trash and actually find the actual useful stuff and useful people. And once you narrow down to those maybe 4 or 5 respectable journalists that you trust, and they aren't usually the ones who are with hundreds or millions of followers. Yep. They can be just 20, 30, 40,000 followers or something like that, which is a lot. But when they have the blue tick and they're actually respected people, mm-hmm. For instance, Paul Joyce, he hasn't even got a blue tick, but he's one of the most respected Liverpool journalists. Every Liverpool fan jumps on every word that he says. So it takes a long time to wade through that. And so when you think about Australians, we're inherently kind of lazy. You know, we just want to drink beer and sit in the sunshine all day long. So why would we be wading through Twitter looking at crap on the other side of the world? And to give you that tiny bit of background on myself, I'm actually originally English. Both my brothers were born in Liverpool. My dad moved there in 75, and I was born in 82. So I never really had a choice. I was born in Cambridge, and we lived down south for most of my growing up years. But two Scouse brothers, I never really had a choice but to follow Liverpool and move down under in 1995 or to New Zealand and Australia in 2000. So I've jumped around a bit, but I've never stopped following the club, basically.
Well, that's the main thing. And, you know, you mentioned social media and the people that you follow from a journalistic point of view. You know, John O'Sullivan is a really good lad. He works for, he does bits for Anfield Index. And I'm not a Liverpool fan myself, but if I were to have a go-to guy, it would be him because I know him quite well, and obviously now you. And there's also Tony Evans, who I've got a lot of time for. Tony, I've known for a good few years and from a personal basis as well, and he's a good lad. So yeah, there are certain people on social media that have a presence within the media industry that I've got a lot of time and respect for. However, as I said before, there are a lot of these influencers and, you know, going back to what you said, trash, utter fucking garbage. And it's very difficult in the UK to get a foothold within this industry because there's so much competition. So yeah, I hope that you go on from strength to strength, because your podcast, I've only heard a few minutes of it, and I struggle as a United fan to listen to this because obviously Liverpool are doing so well, but you know, you've got a hell of a lot of followers there, man, and you're building, which is good.
Thanks, man. I mean, and it took a long time. We started in 2016, and it was just basically because no one wanted me on their podcast. That was the whole point. I was just some random Australian with less than 100 followers, and I asked four or five pods, hey, can I come on? I followed the club my whole life. I'd love to have a chat. And no one wanted me to. And I was just like, all right, well, fine, I'll make my own.
So Why not?
That's what started. And I started it based on, I want to talk to people who don't have very many followers, but have an opinion, have a voice, and they don't get the opportunity. So it became a community-based podcast that way. And 350-odd podcasts later, and we've really slowed down during this break. We're barely doing anything, but we're looking forward to it coming back, and we can continue the ride for the rest of the next following 10 years, I guess.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely. Look, long may it continue. And, you know, if you need anything from me over here, okay, I don't have as many followers as you do, obviously, but, you know, we have our connections, and if there's anything we can do to help you in any way, it'll be our pleasure.
Oh, always. I mean, we connect with the Man United Supporters Club and the actual podcast down here as well, who are really great. So we try and be as, but when I'm so heavy on social media, you have to be balanced. Obviously, you can do some banter between the clubs, but if you're a complete douchebag to all the other clubs and all the other supporters, then you just come off like a prick most of the time. So,
do you know?
So just appreciate you. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry to interrupt you, but it's so scary that you're saying this, because I was talking to my ex's brother about an hour ago, actually.
That's already quite an odd start to a story, but carry on.
It is. But he's a good lad, and, you know, I've known him since he was a kid, and it's been a few years since we last spoke, and he had a death in the family, and I thought I'd message him because obviously I knew the person who passed. And we were just having a conversation, and we were talking about the old days when I used to take him to Old Trafford with me. And I said to him, mate, if I knew then what I know now about some of the ex-footballers that played for Man United then, I wouldn't go, because they're utter shithouses, honestly. But now I find myself talking to people like Emil Heskey, who I didn't like, you know, being a former Liverpool player. I mean, now Emil was a really nice guy, and other ex-Liverpool players, and it's like, wow, I like them more than the players that I used to adore when I was younger. It's weird. It's really weird. Sorry.
Yeah. There's always going to be respect and hatred between clubs. I mean, there's a lot of Liverpool fans who utterly respect Roy Keane. Just mostly because of the way he played, the way he acted. He's a bit of a shithouse to Man United these days with some of his comments.
I love him.
But
I love him.
He's amazing. Yeah, he's got... And, you know, Eric Cantona, a shithouse complete kind of guy to Liverpool players and fans, but you got to respect him. You got to respect these players. And it's just a shame there's that fan rivalry that tries to drive people apart and drive that kind of furiosity apart. I hate Man United with a passion, and I never want them to win anything ever again. But you do have to respect the likes of Sir Alex Ferguson, and I looked into his past and what he did at Aberdeen, and how they've won basically nothing since he left, and he took him past, you know, the UEFA Cup final,
yeah. Real Madrid in the final, yeah. Aberdeen, yeah.
Yeah, ridiculous. You know, someone like that, it's got the pedigree, and then do what he did at Man United, you got to go, okay, shit, fair play, man. He did an amazing job. I can't stand that you did it, because I was there throughout the downfall and watching Souness take over in, you know, 92 and so forth, and us dropping dramatically and our Spice Boys, etc. But and seeing Man United fly, and all my friends were fucking Man United fans back in New Zealand and stuff. But you got to respect it. As simple as that. You just have to respect it.
Yeah. And the one thing I must say, as a long-time United fan, I remember going to games and, you know, when Liverpool came to town, there's always that massive rivalry. It was the fans really disliked each other. But as you get older, you see the younger generation, the way they are now, that it's not as fiery as what it used to be. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a bad thing because the atmosphere in these games isn't as great as what it used to be. But the problem is, as I said before, it's all on social media now. It's all about the banter. It's all about clout. And I'm sick to death of it, really.
Yeah, me too. It's kind of like a blessing being so far away. But I do find myself very much removed from the bullshit. And I make a point of watching my game in thoroughly. And I might do like a half-time post and a full-time post. But I will not let people's opinions sway what I think. And it's really frustrating when you would come on after full time and think, oh, that player had a really solid game. And then you see all these trolls, just go, oh, he's a shithead, oh, he should get sacked and all this stuff. You're like, wow, like, I must have been watching a different type of game or had different expectations of him. But people are really swayed by social media. And my only advice is, folks, I know it's easy to be swayed by other people's opinions, but you got to think for yourself as much as you possibly can. Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with you. And the problem that we have at the moment as United fans, we have certain fan cams, and one of them in particular, they're agenda-driven. And there's a couple of those stars, and I use that term loosely, who have, as I said, they've got their agendas, and people are biting. People are actually taking the bait. It's actually getting them more views. And the problem that we have now is that, same with Arsenal Fan TV, we're being generalised. Oh, that these people represent you. No, not really. They don't represent us at all. These are guys that are paid actors to behave like this. One of them...
They're in entertainment.
Yeah. One of them was a Nottingham Forest fan, and the other one was on Vice talking about, you know, the British government and how bad they are. And all of a sudden, he's a Man United fan, and he's getting free gear from a clothing company? Come on now.
Man. It's a bit odd, isn't it? I know the people you're talking about, and they're kind of like Piers Morgan, you know, they will literally change their agenda based on the way the wind's blowing at that point in time and just carry them through. So he started off being a complete shithouse to Liverpool fans because it got him views. And now he's becoming really nice to Liverpool fans because it's getting him views. It's just whatever, you know, people have got their own agendas, as you said.
Exactly. All right, well, our agenda... Yeah, you see how I did that? Our agenda are your top five matches, and we'll begin. Let's begin with, was it the World Cup final? 1994, yeah. Brazil 0, Italy 0. Now, let's be 100% honest here. A lot of people believe that USA 94 wasn't perhaps the greatest World Cup. For me, I can't say I remember too much about it because of the time difference. So, the time I'd be going to bed is when most of the games were kicking off. I did watch the World Cup final, I did watch the semi-final, and Brazil kind of coasted past their group. They got past Russia, Cameroon, they're already through by the time they drew with Sweden. But then it got a bit bumpy. They just about beat the States. I think Leonardo was sent off in that game. They scraped past the Netherlands, which was a fantastic match. I think Branco scored that fantastic goal. And obviously they met Sweden in the semi-finals, another very good team. Whereas the Italians, again, the Italians, well, they do what the Italians do, you know. They get out of their group just about, and then they beat teams for extra time, they scrape through, and then they get to the final. But this match wasn't a great match. It wasn't a classic. To be fair, neither was Italian 90 final. So there's 2 years, or two World Cups in a row where the matches were pretty shit. But it came to penalties. Marcial Santos, who always was a fantastic central defender, especially at Ajax, missed the penalty. Franco Baresi, the great Franco Baresi, whose shirt apparently always smelt like aftershave, he missed his penalty. But then Albertini, Avani scored. Romario, one of the greatest strikers ever, scored from the spot. Branco, Dunga, Daniele Massaro missed, and then upset Bobby Baggio. And his penalty.
Yeah,
I think they're still looking for the ball. Same with Chris Waddles in Italian 90. So why this game, mate?
There's a lot around this game. I want to put it down to a few factors. It's the last big game I remember watching while I lived in England, because I moved out of England in January 1995. It's the last game I watched with both my brothers all together. So we left one brother in England, left the other brother in New Zealand, and I moved to Australia. So it's so that's that. I was only 12 years old at the time, but that's kind of like the ripe age for like young minds to really absorb football and get right into it and get really passionate. And I was, because of Sensible Soccer, the old computer game.
Oh,
I
yes,
became a
mate.
Huge,
come on.
Yeah. Oh, I started on a thing called Micropose Soccer on C64.
Nice. I'd kick off and kick off two. Yeah, that's a great one. But anyway, sorry.
Beautiful games. Sorry. It was wonderful. No, that's cool. And Sensible Soccer, just I got to know players and clubs from all over the world. And I was constantly playing my brothers at that game. So I got to know football and teams quite a lot and became obsessed with some players because of it. And it all kind of led up to that 94 World Cup. And number 11 became my number because of Romario specifically. So I loved that player and I just couldn't wait to watch him play. And he had Bebeto and they had Dunga and Jorginho and Cafu and Taffarel and Goal and those kind of guys. So it was just a brilliant team. I loved it. And the bright yellow shirt. And just as a kid, I just fell in love with it. So I wanted them to win. And I just remember that final being just crazy. It was really late at night. And then in my area, I grew up north of Hampshire, south of Berkshire, and some kids smashed down the TV aerial or something towards halftime of that game.
Why?
We don't know. I've never looked up as to what actually happened, but I remember it happening and everyone in the area, the TV signal went and was just lucky that our next door neighbor had some German satellite connection. And so everyone in the entire neighborhood just went and congregated in our neighbor's living room. It's like 40 or 50 people shoved it. And he luckily worked for IBM. And so he's one of those, you know, big executives or something next door, dwarfed our house. But we all just shoved into that place and watched the World Cup final. It was just a beautiful moment, to be honest. And I was really gunning for Brazil and watching Baggio's mullet, you know, kick the ball over the top. It was just, you know, great feeling, and I didn't think I would feel that way again. You know, that kind of feeling you have, and obviously there's been a few pretty solid games since then, but it was just a wonderful tournament. I'll also remember another goalkeeper from that tournament from Belgium called Michel Prudhomme.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I've never seen a goalkeeper like him again. Like, we've got Alisson, we've got Schmeichel at the time. You know, you got all these players, but no one was as agile and exciting to watch as him, in my opinion. So, any of you out there listening, go to YouTube, type in Michel Prudhomme, if you can spell it, from Belgium, goalkeeper 1994, and just watch the highlights. Your mind will explode. So it's pretty special.
Yeah. Well, they talk about this Belgian team being fantastic, but the Belgian team back in those days were pretty decent as well. Enzo Schifo, Marc de Gries, all these other players.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I think there's something that we need to touch on with this game. And not many people discuss this, the passing of the torch. I don't think it was intentional. Jorginho going off after, I think it was like 20-odd minutes, and Cafu coming on. Two fantastic fullbacks. And I'm not going to put you on the spot and say, which one would you prefer? Because I think they were both fantastic fullbacks. And Cafu obviously had that longevity. He was playing in his like late 30s, wasn't he? But in terms of the left-back situation, Branco, another fantastic fullback, and he actually could defend, couldn't he? Unlike number six, Roberto Carlos.
Yeah, not many Brazilians could really defend. they never really focus on that part of the game. But yeah, you're completely right. I'm actually a Cafu fan. I think that's just more because I watched more of him than Jorginho. I just knew Jorginho was great, but I think I was too young to really watch him in his prime. But Cafu, yeah, he stood out for me after that point.
I think Thiago, who plays at Bayern Munich, I think his dad played in that final as well, didn't he, Mazinho?
He did play in that game, yeah. But I don't remember him vividly. I was looking at Bebeto and Romario the whole time. a young kid wanting to look at strikers.
Romario was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. Yeah. I talked to Leon Knight about Romario. He absolutely loves him. And, you know, him and Ronaldo, crikey. I know Ronaldo was only 16 in this competition, didn't he? He didn't really play, did he? He even got a game. No. But, yeah, these Brazilians, man, when it comes to strikers, yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very.
Romario actually came to Australia for a brief stint and it was shit. So it was a bit of a shame. So I was like, damn it. But he got one of those big, you know, marquee player signings, I think for Adelaide or one of these clubs over here. And I was so excited. And, you know, it wasn't quite, you know, Dwight York / Robbie Fowler esque kind of work. Del Piero. We've had some pretty cool players over here, but Romario is probably actually the most disappointing, in my opinion.
It's a shame. It's a shame.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Oh, it is what it is. Right, next game. Liverpool 1, Birmingham City 1. Now, if I remember correctly, this was at St. Andrews. I think Birmingham had been like 12 games unbeaten at home. But it was one substitution that has made you select this game, and it was David Ngog coming on for Fernando Torres. And I believe Rafa Benitez blamed it on fatigue, which is why Torres went off. But when you look at that Liverpool team, Griago's in Sua, Aquilani came on. You probably thought, fuck this, I don't want to play anymore. But yeah, why was this game so important to you, mate?
I'm firstly going to preface this that people are probably thinking, hang on, he's just skipped like 15 years of Champions League finals and Olympiacos and all these amazing... I mean, yeah, I try every time I do these kind of things and people ask me for my top five, I try and deviate as much as I can away from the obvious. So, everyone remembers what they were doing in Olympiacos. Everyone remembers what they were doing with Istanbul. So I jumped to this game because it's extremely memorable, apart from the big wins, just so you guys recognize what I'm trying to do here. don't hate me, Liverpool fans. I'm sorry.
No.
So this was a huge game in my mind for a number of factors. I think every Liverpool fan in the world had Gerrard's face on when the Torres substitution happened. And it genuinely broke my heart more than seeing Torres leave the club, because I kind of had a falling out with Torres mentally by that point anyway. But if you watch back, if you ever get to YouTube as well or something, watch the game back when Torres does get substituted, Gerrard's kind of just looking over the bench like, what the fuck are you doing, mate? Like, we need to win this game. We're going for the title. What the hell is going on? Mm-hmm. And it was one of those crucial games we needed to win. But, you know, Rafa was notorious for the rotation policy. We wanted to get people fresh, etc. He was very much better in the cups than he was in the league, even though he kept us top four most of the time. But the most important thing, we end up drawing that game. And I think that was the first time it really took a bit of gloss off Rafa Benitez for me. And I hate that feeling because I love the man and I love him since. And I honestly wish that through all the changes with FSG coming in at the end of that year, instead of having bloody Hodgson come in charge, if he just did stick around for two or three more years, something special could have happened. Who knows? But I think that was really a defining moment at where a lot of fans actually started turning on Rafa. Not as in the majority, of course, but a lot of people started questioning, is he really the right guy? And yeah, it seemed to be like the beginning of the end for him at that point. He left not too long after that as well, half a year or so after that. And it was just hurt, you know, you being so shit for at that point 20 years and getting so close and being the bridesmaids all the time. And to have a decision like that, which you felt as a fan was, fuck, what are you doing, mate? This is our best player, our best attacker. We need him to win. Gerrard's face says it all. And I just looked at it and went, oh, yeah, I can't handle this right now. And we ended up drawing. And all you can think for literally a decade afterwards is, why did he take off Torres? So it's one of those weird moments that I think only Liverpool fans will truly appreciate.
Well, look, it's not as if Fernando Torres' career went from strength to strength after leaving Liverpool. We know about him going to Chelsea. And yes, granted, he won the Champions League there. And that's probably why he went, I guess, or why he—I don't know. There's probably 50 million reasons why he went to Chelsea. But again, after Chelsea, what happened? He went to Atletico Madrid, didn't he? Ended up in Japan. So again, sometimes when players leave big clubs, the career can only go downhill. You know, going back to United, I'm sorry to do this, but I can't think of that many United players that have left the club and gone on to do phenomenal things, apart from maybe Cristiano Ronaldo. You can say David Beckham did well winning MLS a couple times. But in terms of their career progressing and being these phenomenal players, few and far between. I think the same applies to Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about Nani the other day. Mm. And I was like, what happened to Nani? He always seemed on the verge of doing something special and just never really got there. And although my favorite memory of Nani is Carragher making him cry. That was fun. but at the same time, I was like, yeah, you're actually completely right. And you think about the players who left. You had the Nevilles. You know, Neville went off to Everton. I can't remember where the other one went off to. Then you had those two twin Brazilian left and right backs
and
as well.
Fabio, yeah. There's Cardiff, Rafael's in Lyon. I think Gerard Piquet is one you can definitely say did well, very well. In fact, he won the World Cup and was in that phenomenal Barcelona team. But again, yeah. Peter Schmeichel, when he left, he ended up at Sporting Lisbon, Villa, Man City, Japstam. Okay, he won. Did he win the Scudetto of Milan? But it wasn't, you know, anything special.
Oh, wow, wow. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like Memphis Depay. Like, well, yeah, you're a top scorer in bloody league, Farmers League or something. Oof. Like, it's... Yeah. Sorry. Getting a bit far. You know, he thinks he's like the... what's his name? The Bentner of the French league or something. Thinking he should be Ballon d'Or.
He's Steve Harvey's daughter now. He's getting married to Steve Harvey's daughter. Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Good luck to him. Well, good luck to her, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. He's big into his social media as well. It's a bit embarrassing, but yeah, you know, yeah. You do you, Memphis.
Of course. Yeah. Yep. Keep going with those tattoos, mate. There you go.
Exactly. Yeah, we've had a few of them, and we had a few players, quite a few, as you probably know, a lot of our good players left with the Hodgson FSG era coming, and people could see it's going to be a few bumpy years, and it certainly was. And so we had like Maxi Rodriguez leave, we had Mascherano who left, you know, for Barcelona, yeah. Had a few good years there. He definitely went on a high. He made a good decision, really, putting it frankly. So a lot of them left, and it hurts, but you know, the club is much bigger than any one player, as you know.
Oh, absolutely. How did you feel when Xabi Alonso left, by the way? Because for me, he's one of the most underrated midfielders I've ever seen in the Premier League.
Yeah, he's not underrated to Liverpool fans.
Well, of course. But, you know, when you see on social media, I'm sorry to bring this up again, but he's always like, oh, Yaya Toure, but Steven Gerrard, Paul Scholes, Frank Lampard. But
Lampard, yeah.
Alonso was just unreal.
Yeah, unfortunately, most fans these days are stats geeks because you know, they play FIFA and stuff. They don't actually. Yeah, exactly. They're just like, oh, so how many assists did you get? How many goals did you get? He's not up there, and it's embarrassing. But when you watch someone like Xabi Alonso playing, he's very much, he's closer to Scholes than a Gerrard is when it comes to comparisons, because they control the entire tempo of the game. You can't quantify it in goals or assists. So stop making that comparison. It's pathetic. But someone who can literally speed up or slow down a game in an instant and can just pick a pass that you just go, how the hell did he see that? That's what he brings. So people only ever show highlights of his, you know, his long shot, his long goal, and they go, that's what Xabi Alonso is. But it's like, no, he didn't really score any goals. And even in the Champions League final, when he took the penalty and missed it in the first attempt, that was his first ever penalty. So I'm like, why was he taking the penalty? it's weird. But yeah, you're absolutely right. He's just an absolutely genius player.
Great stuff. Right, next game, Liverpool versus Melbourne Victory in 2013. The only thing I remember about this one was you guys took over a cricket stadium, didn't you? Was it 90,000, 87,000, wherever many there were? Liverpool have got a massive following in Australia, and this is what people in the UK don't actually realise until they see it with their own eyes, so to speak. If Liverpool moved or relocated to Australia, they would sell out every game. In fact, all the A-League teams, like your Western Sydney Wanderers, your other Newcastle Jets, whatever, they would have sell-out stadiums. It would be like Wimbledon back in the 90s. You know, when Wimbledon played United and Liverpool, Selhurst Park would be full of United and Liverpool fans. It would be like 10% Wimbledon fans and the rest United and Liverpool. That's what it would be like. There are huge amounts of Liverpool fans in Australia. And I guess you being there at the time, and yeah, it must have been a massive experience for you.
100%. So to preface your point, a lot of expats, I mean, we get loads of English people over here. I mean, I'm one of them, of course. But there's a huge influx. Now, that was the biggest influx was actually in the 70s and the 80s. And that was when a huge amount of English people came down here and said, okay, Australia is actually not a prison country. It is actually it's actually worth living. And, you know, started getting more popularity with Crocodile Dundee and all that kind of shit. So a lot of people moved down here. And at that point, Liverpool were top of England, you know, winning, you know, 3-4 the European Cups and winning the league most years and stuff like that. So it became a huge heritage of the fathers and the grandfathers passing on the love of the club to the kids. And sadly, it's been detrimental to the Australian game. I still can't follow an A-League team. I really, really struggle. It's one of those things where you've grown up your entire life being passionate about a club. And then another person next door saying, hey, you know, support your local. Here's a club down here and you should really support them. I went, yeah, but I got no love for them. I don't know them, don't like the players, don't like the quality. And I devote so much of my years and hours of my day to Liverpool. it's really hard. And that's kind of what it felt like for a lot of Australians. They we have a huge Greek, a huge Italian population. So a lot of people have got a European club in their heart. But Liverpool just seems to be the obsessive club for people here. It's over the top. You'll find Thailand is huge like that as well. Singapore is very Man United. Japan, China, a lot of parts of China, very Man United. But Australia seems to really grasped onto Liverpool from a heritage standpoint. And that's held true for the last 30-plus years. And so for Liverpool to decide, hey, 2013 is going to be a first ever trip to Australia, let's see what we can do. And I was lucky enough to actually be doing some photography work for the club. And so I got to follow them around. I got to be part of their charity work. And so to have my club come to my adopted country, to be in my backyard in the MCG, the Melbourne Cricket Ground, having a capacity of about 98,000 or 100,000 or something, and packing 96,000 fans and probably about 1,000, maybe 2,000 Melbourne Victory fans at most. But even they were singing You Never Walk Alone, and that was what the big climax was, not the game itself. It was the whole build-up to, holy shit, we're going to hear 95,000 people singing You Never Walk Alone at the same time. And then the sub-stories to it, you know, Suarez getting the cheeky 40 million and one bid from Arsenal happening at the time. He was all grumpy and walking in late and with Coates. It was just all these random sub-stories to it. But then it was a magical moment. It'll probably be harder for you to understand because you go to the game a lot. But when you never go to the game and you wake up at 2, 3 a.m. every night for years, I've been doing it for 20-odd years now, watching, I think I've missed 5 games in the last 2 decades live. And so one of them was my wedding, so I have to miss that. But to see them come down under and you go, holy shit, you know, you're playing at a regular hour, you're playing in front of my face, there's 95,000 of my brothers and sisters around me bloody singing the tune, and I don't remember the game. I don't really give a shit what the game was like. I think Aspas scored, and you know, I don't know.
This is it. This is why I like doing this feature on the podcast, because it's your memorable moments, but it's the ones that have sentimental reasons. You know, I've spoken to many people, be it ex-pros, coaches, and they'll talk about games that they've been involved in, and you think, why this game? And they're like, well, this happened before the game, this happened at halftime, we had this talk with the manager, yada, yada, yada. And like I said, these pivotal moments in your life. If you ask me for my top favourite game, the top 5 favourite matches, the first one I will tell you is the Champions League final between Real Madrid and Juventus in Cardiff. And the reason why is because I got my UEFA accreditation, and that was the first game I got with that accreditation. I drove down, or drove sideways to Wales, really. And I spent the day down there, got my photograph, all the ID, you know, did all of that. But the thing is, the reason why it meant so much to me is not because all this hard work and putting all the hours in, as you do, got me to this level. No, because back in 2004, my cousin came over from Cyprus with her son. And myself, her, my parents, we all went to Cardiff for the weekend, and that was when Man United were playing Arsenal in the Community Shield, and I had a ticket, and my dad was going to come with me, and obviously my cousin stayed with my mum at the hotel, and my dad went with me to the game. Anyway, my cousin died of cancer in 2012.
Oh, right?
Now that game at the Millennium Stadium was the same place as the Champions League final, so it was kind of eerie for me, because you know, however many years prior to me going to this final, I actually went to the same city with my cousin. That was the last time she'd ever been to the UK. So for me, that final was like, wow, that's like her giving me this gift. It's weird. It's really weird. So that would be up there. Again, I remember the game. I couldn't tell you what happened, you know, throughout the game, because most of the time I was thinking, wow, I'm at this level. But inside me, I was like, this is too much of a coincidence for it to be a coincidence, if that makes sense. So
yeah, that's incredible. No, and that's what football's about, you know. It brings people together. It gives you memories, gives you things that are way beyond, you know, 22 people running into each other on the pitch trying to chase a little ball. You know, that's not what it's about.
Absolutely. Okay, let's move on to the next game. Liverpool 3, Man City 2. Back in 2014, this was Philip Coutinho's memorable winner, which I still remember to this day, to be honest, gave the keeper absolutely no chance. I think Yaya Toure, didn't he go off injured? I think Henderson got sent off as well in the dying moments. But for you, this must have been a special game.
Yeah, so this had huge build-up, of course. They were a big rival. I don't count them as rivals, I'm sorry. I could never count Man City as rivals. It's I never will. It's as simple as that. They disappeared tomorrow. I won't forget them, and I won't remember them in 10 years' time. As simple as that. It's always going to be Everton and Man United for me. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but they were our title rivals, challengers at the time.
Yep.
And I was packed into Cheers Bar. Cheers Bar is the official home of Liverpool and New South Wales, which is our official Liverpool supporters club. And the place, the build-up, there was a line out the door. The whole place was completely swarming. There's an amazing video on YouTube, and I'll send it to you afterwards, just to see what the fan fanaticism of Liverpool is like down under. And, oh, my God, I stunk of beer for days afterwards. It was wonderful. And just that moment, because I'm pretty sure the game kicked off at about 2 a.m. or so, and just having 200, 300 people packed into this little bar, and just, yeah, it was a mosh pit as well. And then as that final goal goes in, Vincent Kompany flapping with his leg to try and stop it, Coutinho spinning and kicking it into the corner, and just, you can see his face now, his mouth wide open, screaming, his eyes closed as he runs away. Mm-hmm. And, oh my God, just being showered with beer. And, you know, obviously Gerard makes that, "No, we don't let it slip from here" quote, which is not going to be forgotten by a lot of rival fans. But at that exact moment when it went in and we won that game, it was the first time in a long time when I went, "Holy shit, we've got a proper chance to actually win this thing." And just that feeling alone is enough for me to go, you know, "Wow, that was incredible." And yeah, it fell apart after that point on, but that feeling is what will stick with me forever. And that was an incredible moment.
Mm. Well, look, tell me about the end of that season, because I know you had Norwich away, then Chelsea at home with the infamous Steven Gerrard slip, and then Crystal Palace, as they call it, Cristanbul. Where do you think the title was lost that season? Now, the reason why I ask is because I've had this discussion with Liverpool fans on numerous occasions, and they'll say, "Oh, it was the slip, oh, it was the 3-goal lead." And I said to them, "Look,
Henderson's red card or whatever."
Yeah, yeah. The main thing I say to him is, you conceded 51 goals that season. You don't win titles when you concede that many goals. It's that simple.
Yeah. The title was lost in the first half of the season.
Mm.
You know, what we did in the second half, 14 wins in a row, was miraculous. It was unheard of. We shouldn't have had to do that. We lost 5 games in the first half of the season and 1 game in the second half, which happened to be Chelsea. So I don't put it down to Gerrard's slip. I don't put it down to Henderson's red card. I don't put it down to Cristanbul. I put it down to simply we were just shit at the first half of the season. And when the title is based on the most consistent team throughout the entire season, you can't just wipe out and put it down to 1 or 2 games.
Yeah.
You got to put it down to the first half where we lost 5. So it's... it had to be consistent, and it's something that Klopp's now brought into us over the time, that we have to play not full-paced, bloody, you know, heavy metal football. We can't do that. So we've now got the quality players to actually pace out a game and win as 1-0, 2-0, have people whinging and crying about, "Oh, we didn't score 10 goals like we used to in 13-14. It's like, yeah, but we conceded 3 or 4 goals a game as well. It was pathetic. You know, we have to have a full team of performers, and we got to perform throughout an entire season. And you can't win titles by losing 6 games, 5 games in the first half. As simple as that. So, yeah, it happens. We've moved on, and I would still be crying about it if we weren't good now. As simple as that.
There you go. Right, final game. Liverpool 4, Barcelona 0. Now, I'm just going to tell you this for now, because when you lost the first leg, there was one moment which I think changed the whole course of the tie, and that was Dembele's chance. The moment he missed that opportunity or didn't score, I said to my mate, they're going to live to regret that. Now, I didn't think you guys will win 4-0. I thought it might go 3-0, go to extra time, then win on penalties, because you lot are just specialists of penalties. You're like the Germans, really, when it comes to that. But yeah, it was that moment I thought, Barcelona have got it all to do. And even though they were 3-0 up from their first leg, I thought they got it all to do. And Liverpool were just ruthless, relentless. There was no stopping you guys. And obviously, as you mentioned, that message to me, the quick corner, which caught them completely unawares, and Origi scored. So, yeah, talk to me.
I think what people forget is that they look at 3-0 Barcelona and go, they smashed us.
Far from it.
And I think if we didn't play so well in the first half and still lose 3-0, if we didn't play so well, I don't think we would have won the second leg. The fact that we went there and really outplayed them despite the scoreline. And it's so weird to say that, but, you know, Messi genius coming in there. They just, that's what Barcelona do. They find a way to win, even when they're under the cosh. But I don't, they totally underestimated the Anfield impact. And it's just one of those things where I knew if we scored one goal, we would win the tie. It was one of those things where and there were moments in there as well. I think it was Alba or whoever it was that went in to nearly score early, and Alisson saved it. Little moments like that, and a few moments where they could have passed it and actually tapped it in, but instead they just screwed up and they didn't. They tried to take a shot on themselves. There's small moments that happen, but at the end of the day, it was just ruthless and relentless. We scored that first goal early. Henderson goes and takes a shot. Origi goes and follows it up and taps it in early. And at that moment, I was like, we've got this. And I don't think they were quite ready for that. I can't remember, there was a player in the Barcelona's changing room at halftime who was crying, and I was like, this is wonderful. he was like, the people were like, are you okay? And he was actually there crying, like he just couldn't handle the pressure of the game. I think they were thinking of Roma the year before, right. So that definitely helped us.
That's right.
And yeah, and then, you know, we got to remember, we had Shaqiri on because Salah was injured. We had Origi on because Firmino couldn't play. And so we just had, like, Mane on the left. I think that's right. God, my mind's crap this time of the morning. But then Robertson goes off injured, and we're like, oh, shit, now we haven't got a left back. And so we had to stick Milner at left back. We brought Gini on, and then suddenly, bang, we get a goal. And then we're like, oh, fuck, 2-0. Everyone's body kind of just rises. And then, again, what people don't realize is that from kickoff after that goal, Gini scores the header from Shaqiri's corner. And if not corner, from his cross. And we're like, oh, crap, a 3-0 on aggregate. And then, yeah, then that moment of genius from young Trent, who's my favorite player. And, man, you just watch it back. You watched a commentary on LFC TV, and God, your head just explodes as a Liverpool fan just seeing that little moment of genius. I'm still not sure exactly why it stood. I think I'll be pretty salty if it was against us. Didn't look like many people are ready, but the ref was ready. The players looked ready. Origi was clearly ready. Trent was ready. And so the opposition, they didn't really complain about it afterwards too. So credit to them. I guess they realized, yeah, they just switched off. And to execute that shot is bloody hard, the ball coming at him and him slotting it into the right spot. So, yeah, man, I think every Liverpool – I mean, I didn't want to make the obvious games. I didn't want to put the obvious wins in here, but that one you can't leave out, especially it's like a culmination of the Klopp era put together and going, this is what we're about now, and never say die attitude. It's what people at Man United have for years and years and years, winning in Fergie time, 98 minutes from 2 minutes of extra time and finding a way to win, or 1999 Bayern Munich, those kind of situations. That's what champion teams do. It's just to be that now after all these years just felt really special.
Mm. And I think it's kind of poetic in the sense that, you know, Barcelona, the great Barcelona who won so many titles, with Messi there, with, you know, Xavi's, Iniesta's, etc. It's almost as if this is like the passing of the torch, because much as how Barcelona were destroying teams, anyone that came in their way, they're like a juggernaut, Liverpool are doing that now. And I find it remarkable how the mighty have fallen when it comes to Barca. Don't get me wrong, you know, they're still a fantastic side, but Puyol's gone, Piqué's the back end of his career, Messi's just Messi, but he can't go on forever. And then Luis Suarez, I don't know, Busquets is probably the only quality player that can really keep that team together if when Messi's not there. So, yeah, again, passing of the torch.
Yeah, exactly. And Dembele seems to be on and off. They seem to... Griezmann's there, isn't he?
So Griezmann, he's like, yeah.
Well, what's he doing?
Yeah, apart from...
he's there...
Apart from the blackface on its fancy dress, yeah, very clever.
Coutinho, you know, they got the players, but they just don't have the chemistry, and that's something that, you know, someone like Guardiola brings. I remember listening to a podcast about the mentality of managers or the culture side, and they picked Guardiola over all these massive managers who wanted the job at the time because he fit these 10 points of criteria of the culture. Something like 8 of the 10 questions or, you know, criteria they look for are actually culture based, and right now they just don't seem to have their Barcelona culture anymore, and it's wonderful to see.
Well, they're starting to find out that you can't throw money at your problems.
Exactly.
La Masia isn't producing the players that it used to, and, you know, the spending, crikey, the amount of garbage they've brought in recently is just it's beyond laughable. It really is. It smacks of desperation.
Exactly. I was worried Liverpool was going down that route when we started saying, okay, we're going to spend a record amount of money on a defender and then a record amount of money on a goalkeeper. And I was hoping it was going to be like, bring up Ferguson, but, you know, you are a Man United fan, so you understand it more than most. He brought in key players like the Ferdinands and things like that, you know, spend big when he could see, okay, now is a great time to spend big and bring that player in and take a risk. Few of them don't work, of course. I mean, right now we're still trying to work out if Naby Keita is going to work out for us. But at the end of the day, when the key points do work and the team is built around individuals who make up the team, like Gini Wijnaldum from a relegated Newcastle and Andy Robertson from a relegated Hull and Trent from the academy, you know, it's a proper team with the plugs filled by superstars like Mo Salah and Firmino and Mane and Virgil van Dijk and Alisson, those guys. So yeah, I was worried we're going down that same path, but we're really not. We're still keeping to our core of team comes first, players come second. And, you know, you see these clubs like Barcelona spend huge on huge egos without building around a culture which needs to be forged or needs to be maintained, should I say. And they eventually start to crumble because they don't have the mental capacity to deal with the hard times, I think.
Well, look, going back to what you said about signing the goalkeeper and the defender, you could see Liverpool were only a couple of players away from being serious contenders. A season before they got to the Champions League final, you had Karius in goal, for crying out loud. You know, and again, Salah went off injured after that little incident with Sergio Ramos. And you guys went downhill. So obviously, you know, Klopp identified two positions that needed to be improved. And okay, he was back. You mentioned Ferguson. I remember when the treble season, we went in there without a decent central defender. He signed Jaap Stam. He brought in Dwight York. We needed a striker that could come in, that could create but also score goals. And that's what Dwight York brought to us. And he brought in Blomqvist, much as you guys brought in Shaqiri, in the sense that, you know, when your legs are tired and you need someone that can attack fullbacks and really get at them, but also provide goals, assists, etc. That's what Blomqvist did. So, again, great managers know what they want, you know. So I don't... When people say, oh, Liverpool spent money... Tell me one club that didn't ever spend money that was successful. Tell me one club.
Leicester.
Well, all of the players that were there that won the league, they bought them. They signed them. They signed Ulloa, they signed Mahrez, they signed Vardy. They spent money. It's not as if every single player came from the academy, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, every team that has been successful has had to buy players. I can't think of one team that has won titles with 11 academy product youth players. It's never happened.
Yeah, doesn't work.
Never happened. Yeah. So, yeah, you have to spend to be successful, and that's the burn end of it. So when people say, oh, well, you had to spend money, well, you spent money on probably the best central defender in the league, if not the world at the moment. So whatever. Anyway, it is what it is. And I'm waxing lyrical about Liverpool, and I don't even know why.
Yeah. And to bring up Man City again, you know, they've manufactured their winning from only spending. They didn't have the luxury of building a culture and a fan base or, you know, passion around They couldn't do that. They couldn't say, hey, we're Man City, and despite us being crap, you know, come follow us. They'll have their core following of people who've always followed them. But they had to start winning games really quickly, so they had to invest, and they spent billion pounds, sorry, on players. And it's a disgusting way to do it, but, you know, credit to them, they did it. And let's see how long it lasts, because I don't think that's going to continue much longer. But we'll see what goes on from there. It just goes to your point.
The thing is with City, it's a difficult one because we've never really experienced this before. Okay, granted, you can talk about Abramovich, but with Abramovich, he didn't spend the money that City's owners have had. And by that, I mean, when you look at City, they've completely changed the dynamic of the club. They've built a new training ground. They've got a college there. They're doing a lot with the local community. And I'm not going to mention any alleged brand envelopes handed to, you know, people within the council, but, you know, whatever it is, what it is. But you could tell that there's like a long-term project there with the owners. And you could call it sports washing, which we're probably going to see with Newcastle if and when they get taken over by the Saudis, which I'm not going to go into again. But with Abramovich, obviously he spent money at the club and he's saved Chelsea from going under, and he does a few other things here and there. But again, I think with City, they've got a long-term project there. So I don't know what it is, but you can see that they're planting the seeds for something. But again, going back to what you said about, you know, their fans have always been there, but obviously as success breeds fans, doesn't it? It brings new fans and new supporters. And I could go to, I don't know, the local shopping mall, you know, okay, obviously I can't now because of COVID, but, you know, in the past I could go to the mall and I could see a kid wearing a City shirt. And I'm thinking, have you ever heard of Paul Dickov and Joe Royal and Nicky Weaver when they were in Division 1 and Division 2? Obviously not, but you know of your David Silva's, your Aguero's, because of the winning mentality that the City have got. So, whatever. Anyway.
Exactly. It's what attracts the new breed, new age, and frankly, they're the money spender. Well, their parents are the ones who spend the money. They're the ones who will say, yeah, I'll buy a shirt for my kid because he loves Man City or whatever. And that they generate the revenue. Yeah. So, and it just comes, and it'll always ebb and flow.
Yeah, it's happened with United. I'm seeing Paris Saint-Germain shirts now. Listen, that's how it is. I think the only difference between now and when you and I were younger is that we always supported the club, whereas these days, because of the FIFA generation, it's supporting where the player goes. So you're either Pogba or you're De Bruyne or you're Mbappe or this and that. And it's weird. It's a weird thing for me. I don't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't know where Romario played, which club he played for. I just know he played for Brazil. And so I didn't follow him that much, but I did love the way he played. And to that point, the only thing that really bothers me, especially with the social media era, kind of doing a full circle back in our conversation, is that these people don't realize that football is extraordinarily cyclical. And the Man City fans online seem to believe that they have some divine right to every single title because they have a huge squad or for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. If they lose, they don't win a title or something or the other. It's someone else's fault or someone's trying to do a conspiracy against them. They have to realize that their time will drop. Then they will come back up again. Then they will drop, like Liverpool, huge for 20-odd years. And then we've dropped for 30. Man United have been huge for 20-odd years, and you had dropped before that 20 years, and you've dropped now for the last 10, comparatively. Arsenal, you know, if you don't recognize in yourself that your club will be cyclical in their success, and you have to stick with them through the hard times, then you're not a real fan. The real fans are the ones who are defined by how they support their club when they need you most, not when they need you least. I just hope that they, for the sake of Man City as a club, I hope their fans do actually stick around and stick by them when their success does actually start to drop.
Yeah, well, they need to start selling tickets first. But anyway, I won't go into that. That's another little cheap dig I've had.
Ouch, I love it. Right in the kidneys.
That's how we do. Well, Nish, thanks for your time, mate. Really, really appreciate you going up so early to jump on the show with me. Before I let you go, plug anything you want, my friend.
If you'd like to follow the LFC Couch, please do. It's our podcast. We're not doing a huge amount right now, but we're on the usual channels, on iTunes, on Spotify, all those places. You can follow us on Twitter, at LFC Couch, at LFC Couch, and myself, I'm Couch Nish, N-I-S-H. So feel free, give us a follow. I'm all up for a chat. I mostly spend my time bantering and just having, you know, cheap jokes and cheap laughs. So I don't take life too seriously, please. I've got better things to do than to be angry online. lovely talking to you, mate. Really appreciate the chat as well.
Pleasure's all mine. Really appreciate it. I hope we could do this again sometime. It'll be great. We'll talk about maybe like your favourite goal. How about that?
Oh, damn, I've got favorite a lot of
goals.
Those.
Top 10 favourite Jeez. Goals. There you are.
Great stuff. I got plenty. Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much for the chat.
No worries, mate. Cheers. Right, cheers. Guys, those of you still listening, we're on Twitter at Shoot Defence. We also have a lovely Instagram page where I'm posting a whole load of retro football stuff. As I said before in previous pods, I've gone into my attic and my loft and found some old Shoot and Match magazines. I've been posting there like a demon. So yeah, feel free to ask any questions. We're here. And so until next time, take care.